My name is David Rutenberg. I'm a third-year law student at Vanderbilt and an articles editor on the Environmental Law and Policy Annual Review. Over the past few months, it's been my pleasure to work with each of our three panelists in preparation for today and for the latest issue of LPAR. This panel will discuss Professor Jonathan Adler's recent article, Eyes on a Climate Prize, Rewarding Energy Innovation to Achieve Climate Stabilization, which was originally published in the Harvard Environmental Law Review. Professor Adler's article argues that government-funded inducement prizes are an underutilized option for incentivizing research and development related to the type of transformational technological innovation that can make climate stabilization both achievable and affordable. Professor Adler, sitting just to my left, is Professor Law and Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western University School of Law. He is the author or editor of four books and has published over a dozen book chapters. His articles have appeared in publications ranging from the aforementioned Harvard Environmental Law Review to the Washington Post. And we won't go into every place he's been published, but let's just say, suffice it to say, he's widely published. Professor Adler holds a JD from George Mason University School of Law and a BA from Yale University. Our second panelist, sitting to the left of Dr. Adler, is Dr. Timothy Brennan. Dr. Brennan is a professor of public policy and economics and a senior fellow with Resources for the Future. He was previously an economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors, as well as an economist with the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. He has advised on competition law for authorities in countries including Australia, Costa Rica, Mexico, Russia, Slovak Republic, Sweden, and Uzbekistan. Dr. Brennan holds a PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a master's and bachelor's in mathematics from University of Maryland College Park. And our third and final panelist is Dr. Larry Cooper. Dr. Cooper is a program executive for the NASA Centennial Challenges Program, which uses incentive prizes to drive technological change. At NASA, he previously worked at the Lewis Research Center in aircraft emission reduction, and later led a series of rocket engine research and development programs. Prior to joining NASA, he led the Space Science Group in the Ohio Aerospace Institute. Dr. Cooper holds a BS, an MS, and a PhD from the University of Illinois, as well as an MBA from the University of Cincinnati. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Professor Adler.
Thank you. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. And in light of some of the comments Dan made at the end of the last panel, I should say that part of the inspiration for this paper was an effort to, or grew out of an effort to look at what sorts of policy measures and what sorts of tools those of us who take climate change seriously but are also skeptical of a lot of, or the value and desirability of a lot of conventional policy tools, in particular regulatory tools, if that's one's starting point, then what should one think about? If one's view isn't to simply ignore climate change as a problem or decide it's too difficult or too costly to address, then what are the alternatives, or what are at least things that could, as alternatives, what are things that might complement or facilitate approaches to climate change? And as already mentioned, the paper argues that one tool that's been underutilized and something that should be part of our policy toolkit is the use of technology inducement prizes to encourage the development of climate-friendly technologies. And I should note this is something of a moving target because in the last couple of years, certainly since the original draft of the paper was written for publication, there has been increased attention to the use of prizes. The Obama administration in particular has paid a lot of attention to prizes, has tried to promote their use by agencies, encourage discussion of where prizes might be useful, and has sought to encourage agencies to use existing budgetary authority for prizes where that is allowable. I'd love to claim credit for all of this, but the paper wasn't published when a lot of this had happened, and I scrambled to get as much of that into the paper while it was going through the publication process, much to the chagrin of the student editors at Harvard who were working on it, who had to deal with constant requests from me to add footnotes or add additional discussions. So basically what my proposal is, and I'll try and briefly outline why I think this is a good proposal, is that what the federal government should do is to reallocate a certain portion of the money that we currently devote to energy-related, and in particular climate-related research and development, away from grants and subsidies toward technology inducement prizes. I think this is both a way to increase the overall level of innovation and climate-friendly innovation and increase the likelihood that we get the sorts of innovations that we need, but also the sort of tool that should be particularly attractive at a time like this, when there isn't a lot of money to go around and when most policymakers are looking for opportunities to cut spending rather than to increase it. So as an initial matter, though, I'll say a little bit about why I think we need innovation in this area. And the basic reason is that atmospheric stabilization is one of those challenges that we don't really know how to achieve in a way that's acceptable politically or socially or economically. Even achieving the goal of 80 by 50 is something that is 80% reductions by the year 2050 is something that people find quite daunting. Not that it's not achievable, but something that we recognize as requiring dramatic changes. And just to throw out a few numbers about the sorts of changes we're talking about, 80% reductions, or we're talking about reducing greenhouse gas levels or greenhouse gas emission levels in the United States to around where they were in 1910. Two facts about 1910 that might be relevant. The population of the United States was only 92 million people, and per capita income was about $6,200. In the year 2050, population will be about 400 million. That's our best estimate for the United States. So the reduction in GHG levels on a per capita basis are, as best we can tell, around the levels of what they would have been in Reconstruction. Again, that doesn't mean it's impossible, but I think that those numbers help crystallize that what we are talking about is dramatic changes in the sorts of technologies that we use and deploy and rely upon for things in our everyday lives in terms of economic production and the like. And current technologies at current costs will have a hard time doing that. And then to magnify the problem even more, it doesn't matter just what we do, but what matters is what happens globally. And I'm certainly one that believes that unless we can find a way to make greenhouse gas controls compatible with economic development through the bulk of the world, we don't have much of a chance of achieving stabilization. That is to say, unless we can find a way to make it inexpensive, if not actually profitable, to control greenhouse gases in the bulk of the world, it won't happen. And so it is imperative that we adopt a mix of policies that maximize the likelihood that we can achieve this. And so there's a need for innovation. So the next question is, well, why isn't this happening? And certainly for someone like myself, who generally is a big proponent of markets and believes that markets are incredibly efficient and do tend to spur lots of innovation, the obvious question is, well, why isn't it happening? And in the case of climate change, as in the case of many environmental matters, we don't see private investment at the levels that we would like because it is not possible for innovators to capture the value of those investments given the nature of lots of environmental problems. In particular, the commons nature of a lot of environmental problems, the commons nature of the global atmosphere, means that someone who develops a new technology for the reduction of greenhouse gases cannot capture the full value of that the way that someone who develops a more efficient way of producing a widget can capture that value. That is, a lot of the value of the emissions reduction technology are the reduction of emissions, and since those emissions aren't priced, there's no price on carbon, there is no way to capture that portion of the benefit. And so even if we recognize that there are lots of technologies, like say energy efficiency improvements, that also result in greenhouse gas emissions, it's possible for the innovator perhaps to capture the energy efficiency value and the value that comes from that portion of the innovation, but the value that results from reducing greenhouse gas emissions is not captured. And so that means that some of our traditional tools, like the patent system, don't provide sufficient innovation or sufficient incentive for innovation for the sorts of technologies that we're talking about. And that's true in climate change, but I think that's true for lots of environmental problems where we're dealing with the use of common resources. And so whereas patents typically operate by providing innovators or would-be innovators with the prospect of super competitive returns, in the case of climate change, a would-be innovator doesn't even get competitive returns. In fact, what they are faced with is the promise of sub-competitive returns at best. And so my suggestion is that prizes are a particularly useful way to try and address this lack of sufficient incentives. That prizes can in fact replicate the incentive system that the patent system provides. That is, a properly designed prize can offer a would-be innovator the promise of super competitive returns in the form of the value of a prize. In the patent system, we do this by guaranteeing a monopoly. With a prize system, we do this by guaranteeing some sort of economic prize for the person that discovers or the sort of thing that we want. And so my argument, again, is that we should have technology inducement prizes. And in the paper, in the version that is going to be published in ELR, and in the longer version in particular, I go through the history of prizes, because there was certainly a period of time where the dominant tool used by governments to stimulate the development of technologies that were socially desirable, or at least that those in power thought were socially desirable, were achieved through prizes. That is, before we had national academies of sciences and the like, this was what was used. And one of the most famous examples is the Longitude Prize that was used by the British government, that was in desperate need of finding a way of being able to measure longitude for its vessels, both for purposes of trade and for the projection of its military power. Napoleonic France used prizes for, among other things, food preservation technology, because it was important for the Napoleonic armies to be able to preserve food, because they could not always depend upon those that they conquered might not always be thrilled about providing food to their to the invading armies, and so food preservation technology was particularly important, and so on. And here we have identified socially desirable technologies. That is, technologies that would enable us, or at least make it easier for us, to try and achieve atmospheric stabilization of greenhouse gases, and prizes could here again do that. We have a desire to induce private investment, not just generally, but towards the achievement of particular goals. And it turns out that the U.S. Climate Change Technology Program has actually done quite a bit of work trying to identify the sorts of innovation paths and the sorts of innovations we would like to see. Now, my argument is that prizes will do a better job of actually maximizing the chance that we can go down those paths than traditional R&D grants, in part because prizes, like the patent system, really open up the field to a wider range of potential innovators. They don't depend upon people already being in existing institutions that already are in line to receive government grants, that already can satisfy the requirements for government support and the like, but rather anyone that believes they can achieve the innovation, or that they can satisfy the requirements of the prize, is able to do so. And one thing we know from the history of technological innovation is that the most valuable innovations typically come from unexpected places. Again, the Longitude Prize is a perfect example of this. Everyone assumed that the answer to the longitude problem was in astronomy. And all of the folks that were kind of in the official channels, that were in the big scientific institutions, were focused on, okay, how do we use our knowledge of the stars to find a way to measure longitude? But it turned out that at the time the best way to do it was the design of a better clock that could survive the rigors of sea travel and deal with those problems. Had the British Empire relied upon a top-down grant approach to solving the longitude problem, it would not have been solved. And too often, if we rely upon the foresight of a select narrow group of very intelligent, very well-intentioned individuals, we will often miss the innovation that is so important precisely because it comes from the unexpected place. So part of my argument is that, at least for this sort of problem, the sort of problems that we're dealing with climate change, where we need dramatic technological innovation, that prizes are, on the margin, better than grants. for purposes of discussion, I certainly would say that for applied R&D generally, I tend to think that prizes are better than grants. But for purposes of my proposal, I think all that's necessary is for one to accept that prizes at least have some virtues that grants don't replicate. And so diversifying the way we invest in technological development and technological innovation is therefore warranted. And so what are some of the things that the prizes do that grants don't? Well, one is they're comparatively decentralized. You know, they're not dependent upon those that already work through established routes of receiving financial support from the government. I've already mentioned that a little bit. There are certainly fiscal advantages for the federal government. One advantage of prizes is that the history of prizes shows that there is a multiplier effect. That is, the amount that is invested in pursuing the prize is often substantially greater than the prize itself. That is, when you look at all the folks that chase after the prize. And in fact, we've seen in many cases, because of the reputational benefits or because of other benefits that those seeking prizes believe they can capture, even individual prize-winning teams often invest more than the value of the prize. This was true with the Ansari X Prize. If you want to see the winning entry there, I believe it's still on display at the Air and Space Museum down the street, but the best estimates are that the winning team spent double the value of the prize, and it looks also that winning team, though, that was a good, that wasn't just because of the egos of those that wanted to say they won that prize, but it turns out that there are commercial applications that they are pursuing. So from the standpoint of the federal government saying, how do we really ramp up the amount of money that's going into trying to solve these problems, prizes do that in a way that grants do not. Because with the grant, the amount of money that gets invested is the amount of money the federal government puts on the table. With a prize, the amount of money that gets invested is what's invested in pursuit of the prize. And while economically it's certainly true that we may worry about, in a macro level, there being some a welfare loss from spending too much money pursuing a particular goal, in the case of climate change, I think we're clearly in a position where we are underinvesting. And we are a long way off from a position where we'd be worried about too much money being spent on how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The other benefit for the taxpayer, too, is that the prize only gets awarded if there's something that's innovated. And so all the stories you read about the federal government, whether it's with R&D grants or with subsidies or recent efforts to try and play venture capitalist, of the money going out and then producing nothing in return, a lot of those problems are really avoided with prizes, or at the very least reduced, because the check only gets written if the innovation is met. Last point, because I think I'm over my time, is that the political economy of prizes, I think, also are important, and that is that prizes are, on the margin, significantly less prone to rent-seeking than traditional grants, and certainly than traditional energy subsidies. This, unfortunately, it appears, is one of the reasons why prizes went out of fashion. That is to say, those doling out money tend to like to know who the money's going to, and there are substantial interests in keeping money flowing along certain lines, so that makes it difficult. That makes it difficult to adopt prizes in the first place, because they don't have the natural constituency that either energy subsidies or traditional R&D grants have. But once they are in place, it's one of the reasons why we can generally expect them to be better at in terms of what they seek to incentivize. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I'm really happy to be here. I was just to let some people know what kind of dinosaur is speaking to you. I was trying to remember if I'd ever been in this building before, and I've been in this building once. I was here in 1973. I came down here while I was in college to check out the Watergate hearings, and I was actually in the room, the hearing was in this building, when John Dean spilled the beans on the cancer and the presidency. So that's my sort of brush with history here. I want to thank Linda, David, and Lindsay, and everybody for all of this. It's a real pleasure to be here just institutionally, in the sense that I've worked with ELI before on some projects. I consider myself not just a friend of ELI, but actually paid up. I'm a dues-paying associate member of ELI, so they were too nice to avoid the commercial, so I'll do it. And I was not asked to do that. It was volunteer work. I also had the pleasure of giving some talks at Vanderbilt a few years ago. A good friend of mine, Luke Frobe, is in the business school, so I gave some talks on there. I think I also gave a talk at the law school on some antitrust stuff. I think I'm part of the Microsoft case at the time. I had a paper going on about that. And Luke may be known to some people at Vanderbilt. He's somewhat legendary in that he went on a laundry strike some years ago. He wore the same, he said he was going to wear the same shirt to class until Congress repealed the capital gains tax. You have to kind of know Luke to know that that's sort of typical of him. I probably should also say a little bit before getting started about what RFF is in case people don't know. My main job is teaching at UMBC, but I'm also at Resources for the Future, which is Linda may wince at this, but I would like to think of it maybe as an economics equivalent of ELI. I mean, it's an independent, nonpartisan, pretty much straight research place, but trying to do a lot more policy engagement. But, you know, we're happy to take money, but, for-profits can't fund specific projects and that sort of thing, so we retain editorial independence over what we do. We think of ourselves mainly as like a university that does a lot of policy engagement, so it's a very independent place in that regard. And what I'm talking about is arises from some joint work I've done with a colleague at RFF. Molly McCauley is vice president for research there, and Kate Whitefoot, who's now at the National Academy of Engineering. Molly's done a lot of work for NASA. I was just talking to James about that a little bit. So that's where we're at. And the paper we have just starts off with this. Okay. It starts off with this quote, which actually speaks to something that Jonathan mentioned a little bit. When George Carlin was awarded the Mark Twain Prize, people may remember this, for comedy, he died shortly thereafter of a heart attack. And his daughter, this quote from the Washington Post, his daughter found something in there about how that Carlin had written about how pleased he was that he'd won this prize. And he said, and according to his daughter, the note said, that Carlin said that an award is something grown-ups win, a prize is something a kid wins, which is why Carlin was happy to do that. I'm quoting that partly because it applies and partly because the opportunity to quote George Carlin in the Senate office building was just too awesome to pass up. So just very briefly, my interest in this actually, although Molly sort of brought me into this because of her familiarity with prizes at NASA and other places and her interest in this, I got interested in it probably because of a question that I'd run across from antitrust where I've done some work, as David had mentioned, some other things, which is a lot of people talk about we need to sort of jig around the antitrust system because innovation's out there and it's really important. I think, well, we've got lots of things for understanding innovation. As Jonathan said, well, you know, like, why prizes? And the interesting thing to this is sort of ivory tower-ish, is that if you try to look at the economics of this, you think, well, hey, economics, don't they understand incentives better than anybody in structures? But it turns out that if you look at the economic models of patents, they treat patents as prizes. You know, the successful innovator gets a pile of profits at the end of the day, you know, for that. And so if economics treats patents as prizes, you can't use economics to tell you why use patents rather than prizes. And that sort of inspired us thinking about this. There's some stuff out there about how, well, you know, maybe if the government buys out patents, you could get stuff supplied cheaply. This is a really big deal. In fact, there's a lot of literature in this in law reviews as well on the virtues of having government buyouts of patents for pharmaceuticals, so you get drugs available in developing countries at prices obviously far, far below the market thing. And so the reason I think that Jonathan's work is so important here is that we really know a lot less about this stuff than one might think. So that's basically what we've been thinking about. As I said before, I don't think government buyouts of patents are the answer here. In other words, just letting somebody do a patent, have the government buy it, and then dole it out. There's a lot of reasons why that's not so good. As Jonathan pointed out very, very well, I'm a market guy too. And say I'm, you know, it's like everyone here is a law professor or a practitioner. Well, not quite. I'm sort of the economics professor in the room, I guess. And so I'm, you know, I've been drinking the Kool-Aid for a while. So I think, you know, the markets are going to work pretty well for things, but it's not going to work because because we don't price greenhouse gases right. And it'd be very easy for an economist to say, well, of course, that's what we ought to do. And we know how far that goes in these buildings. But you know, we do have this problem. So you have the so-called second best solution. Maybe we need to do some other things. But there are these other things out there. You could do like R&D things. You could have production tax credits. There's all kinds of stuff out there. Jonathan talks about this in comparing prices to grants. A slight quibble here, and if you want to discount that, because I work for two organizations, a university and a research institution, that depend upon grants, maybe you think, well, I'm probably going to be the last person to trash them. But it's not clear that prices are any, you know, that they're just as centralized. Some government agency, if we're talking about public grants, has got to put them out. They have to specify the victory conditions. There's a lot of central control there. Whereas for grants, people propose lots of things, and some peer review panel decides. It's not, you know, I haven't maybe done a lot of this, but I don't, my impression serving on NSF panels and things like that isn't that these are, you know, that there's like, you know, political allocation of these things, but I may be wrong about that. And that you know, there are risk reduction things on both sides of this. So I'm not exactly sure that how much of it, you know, that the things are that bad. But that's a quibble relative to the important points that I think Jonathan has made here. In thinking about this question, I think that there are a bunch of institutional advantages to keep in mind. The first is the stuff that I think Jonathan alluded to about what it is that gets people to spend more on these things than the prize, whatever it might be, publicity benefits, social contributions, whether it's fun in the Carlin quote. There's educational things. Hey, this is a great way to provide things for our students. Let's get them to participate in this engineering project to, like, you know, have a solar car race across the country or something along those lines. I have to confess, I was entertained by the bringing up the Ansari X Prize example. A team including Richard Branson, Paul Allen, and Burt Rutan, to say, well, ego probably had nothing to do with it. Was probably a bit of a stretch. But there's other things, which is that unlike the patent system, patents are winner take all and that's it. There are a lot of contests, especially there's a lot of private contests too, besides public ones, where you can do things like give prizes along the way, give second prizes, give third prizes. There's all kinds of things that one can do to try to, you know, mitigate some of the risk things and stuff like that that the patent system just doesn't have the flexibility for. You can manage contestants. There's a trade-off here between competition, perhaps, and benefits of avoiding redundant things, maybe getting things faster, that sort of thing. But that's happened. You know, the Netflix prize is a really good example of this. People haven't heard about that. This is, you know, they had a prize competition to basically improve their algorithm on movie recommendations. I think it actually even made the New York Times Magazine not that long ago. One other advantage is that, you know, just because you have a patent doesn't mean you really have a patent. Whereas if you get the victory conditions, you know, you've won the prize, and presumably that's not as subject to litigation, although people, maybe they will be in the future, I don't really know. But I think the biggest one to emphasize here is that even if you had the right price structure, not all innovations or things are patentable. To take the X Prize as an example, the idea of the first suborbital flight, and you had to put these victory conditions on, had to do it within 2 weeks and these other sorts of things, you can't patent that. You may have patentable equipment, machinery, processes, things to do that sort of thing, but you can't patent that or the 100 mile per hour car or various emissions things and stuff like that. So one thing that a hole that a prize can fill is just giving a reward for something that you simply can't get a patent for under the patent law. Just to close, we've been thinking about this, about whether there's some economic fundamentals here. And I think that there's a couple of key differences between prizes and patents to keep in mind. One is that because of the victory conditions, prizes tend to be very specific. Someone has the idea to have a prize for this thing, and then you specify very particular things. Patents are nice, they're kind of open-ended. Someone's got an idea, and they get a patent for it. Not quite that easy, obviously. The other thing is risk. If you're in a patent game, you know, you're basically bearing it all. You're bearing the risk of how much it's going to cost you to do it, and you're bearing the risk of whether, you know, how much, what the benefit you're going to get from it is. You know, are other people going to come up with competing patents? Is there going to be litigation? What will the demand for this thing be like by the time you succeed? All kinds of things like that. Whereas prizes mitigate at least some of that on the reward end. You know, maybe not a lot, depends how big the prize is, but there may be something, a risk benefit there. Which strikes me that prizes are probably better when you know what you want and there's an important reason to share risk. Patents are probably better when you don't know what you want and maybe you're not quite as concerned about risk aversion, at least in the innovation community relative to the government, which, I mean, risk doesn't disappear, it's just who's going to absorb it. Now, where we've left this on our own is that we have this idea. You know, then the question for, you know, on the ivory tower side is it would be nice to have kind of a formal economic model of this. I'm not sure at the end of the day it's going to add very much. I mean, a lot of things, well, you know, depending upon, you know, whether this parameter that I can't measure is bigger than this parameter that I can't measure will tell you whether to do one or the other. I'm not sure it's going to really improve the state of the policy advice on this, which again, I think is why Jonathan's insights are so valuable here in terms of getting people to think about these things. In the ways, you know, for all the points that he's made on them. So I'm really glad that he's done this. I'm glad we have the opportunity to talk about prizes. So thanks very much.
Tim, when you have an academic paper that's part of the abstract, this paper doesn't say very much.
Oh, that's, you won't be the first to make that observation about my papers, actually.
While they're getting things queued up over there, I again want to echo my panelists' statements and thanking everybody for inviting all of us to come and talk about this particular, you know, area. And it's, you know, it's an exciting time in the prize community for these kind of discussions about prizes, you know, writ large, and in particular the discussion we have today about the application of prizes to environmental mitigation problems. So when I took a look at the paper, I mean, I've been in this job at NASA for just about a year as the manager for the Centennial Challenges program. And that was a program that was started back in 2005. We were one of the first agencies in the country that was given authority by Congress to offer prize competitions of this nature, where we actually had a cash prize that the government gave out. We've been doing prizes and competitions for years and years and years, where we were handing out bookmarks and pins and certificates and things like that. But the idea of having the authority to literally give out as much as $50 million for a prize competition was a real novelty. And the testimony that was offered at the time, led to changes in the NASA Space Act, which is the authority we use to run this particular program, were really quite interesting. Go back and read those transcripts as I took this job last year. So by and large, as Professor Alderson and Tim have said, prizes are, I'm on board with prizes. I mean, that's my bread and butter. That's what I do for my day job now. What I want to offer is a little bit of insight from somebody who's in the trenches actually using these things, and maybe a few examples to sort of cement in your minds some of these points that were raised earlier. So if we can find the forward button. All right. So what's the big deal with prizes? The paper goes through several of of these things, I'm completely in agreement from somebody who's actually in the trenches using these things. I have some concrete examples that yes, these things actually do work this way. This is not just an academic exercise. In terms of stimulating innovations in a way that is unlike contracts and grants, and in particular, the fact that competitors don't get paid until we get what we want. That is like a real sea change in dealing with parties on the other side that we're trying to acquire technologies from. an example being our Green Flight Challenge, which we concluded this last fall. We were basically looking for, the challenge was to for somebody to build a general aviation scale aircraft that would fly at least 200 miles, get at least 100 miles per hour speed over that that 200 miles, and use less than a gallon of gas or the energy equivalent per person. And we had 14 teams sign up. We had four that actually made it to the competition. If we had gone out and done this as a typical government grant or contract or whatever, I would have had at something on the order of a 1 in 14 chance of picking the the winner. That in itself, I would have like, all right, well, this guy. They all had great design ideas. So it was a 1 in 14 chance. We ended up getting four people there. The aggregate investment that they made was a little over $6 million. Our prize purse was about $1.5 million. So there was about a 4-to-1 leverage there in terms of the aggregate investment. Another four teams that actually weren't on track to actually compete when we had the competition have continued to mature their technologies, and they will be bringing their aircraft to an electric aircraft symposium that's happening later this month, and that'll be the first flying that they will be doing. Certainly, from that perspective, grants and contracts and the fact that we don't have to pay until we actually get something that we want, is important. We get these at a fraction of the cost or traditional procurement. If we had to go through federal acquisition regulations and all of the bureaucracy that entails and the reports and the oversight and everything else, I don't know that any of these 14 teams would have actually decided to work with the government under those terms. All of these people were pretty much small innovators from around the world, which reaches to the second point there, which is new sources of innovation and new talent that don't reach through traditional means. Several of the people that have worked in our programs in the past have gone on to commercialize their technology. We had a fellow who won a challenge called the Astronaut Glove Challenge. It came up with a new and better way to manufacture gloves for our astronauts. He's gone on to form his own small company called Flagsuit LLC. And he's commercializing that technology and on the verge of selling it to the Department of Defense and as using a spacesuit as a portable hyperbaric chamber for getting military people who have suffered traumatic brain injuries into a medical environment that helps stabilize and mitigate their problems. So you never know where some of this technology is actually going to go. He's partnered with our primary station spacesuit people now. So the real question is not so much as like, our prize is great. Yes, prizes are great. They do a lot of things that you can't do with other directions. But are they right for the climate mitigation problem? So they're really useful when you've got problems in which you know what your objectives actually are. If you say, if you're going to say you want an airplane that goes 200 miles and 100 miles per gallon, you need that to really have a concise definition in your mind. What problem are you trying to solve? And then you need to create rules, which will allow you to determine whether or not somebody's actually won. So it's very important to have a very clear problem statement in mind. It works best when there isn't, it's already flooded with a lot of funded research. And in some cases, it's not clear whether that's, just where we're at on that. I mean, everybody can argue that there ought to be more research, in environmental, mitigations. Some people would say, we're spending too much money on it. So not so clear on that one. And then finally, is there's going to be any economic return that you're going to draw the attention of competitors? if you don't have an economic return, you know, that you can look forward to, then you're going to have to set up a prize structure that is going to basically potentially compensate them for the investments that they're going to make. If they don't see any back end to this, you know, they're going to look for that prize to cover all of their expenses, and that's assuming that they win, and they're going to have to make their own decisions about how many other competitors they're going to be facing. So these things work best where there are problems that do have an economic future in front of them if they're successful. And in selective areas, this is obviously true for climate mitigation, particularly in the areas of things which are contributing to energy efficiency or things where capturing carbon from the air and things like that and turning it into products that you can sell, things like that. There are problems that are out there. So in terms of a present status on prizes, in general, as Jonathan mentioned a couple of years ago, last December, they had a reauthorization of the America Competes Act, which extended the authority to offer prize funding and competitions to pretty much all the federal agencies, and so that's been something that's a fairly recent development. The Office of Science and Technology Policy released just this week their first annual report on prizes and competitions under the America Competes Act, and there's a handful of these that have actually been done under the America Competes. Several others, many other examples are in there which are using other authorities, such as my program, which uses a Space Act authority, and you can offer competitions, using contracting authority and things like that. But it's new and it's growing. There's a small group of us, that's sort of the community of practice. And I'm going to say, despite the benefits of prizes as we perceive them, this is a pretty much a new tool, and for most of the people in the federal government, the safe way to do business is the way you've been doing business, which is to use contracts and grants and things like that. It takes a little bit of a leap of faith to go into your boss and say, hey, I've heard about this new authority. I'd like to offer a prize. Then you have to explain what all this is, and sometimes it's just easier to do otherwise. So in the absence of some top-down direction, be it from Congress, the White House, OSTP, or whatever, actually directing agencies that you must use prizes, It's going to, in my view, be a bit of a slog. We've been talking about kind of being a generational thing almost, in which we're going to probably have to educate our new employees as they come in when they go through and they learn about grants and how to run a grant program or how to do a contract program, but they also should be educated on how to do a prize program. So it becomes something that they are familiar with. It's just something else in their toolkit that they might want to take out to work on some of these problems. So in terms of the prize proposal that Jonathan put forward, and this was my reading of it. I'm not sure whether this is what he actually intended in terms of how to approach this or not, but the idea that there should be some top-down thing saying, you need to just go off and allocate some fraction of your contracting or research money to prizes. You can do that. I think that it's likely to result in chaos. There's just probably not enough people out there in the federal government right now that actually know much about all of this stuff. And the question is, they're going to evolve in how much should I put for a particular prize competition? How do I figure out how to do all of this stuff? And in the end, the prizes are going to expand to the amount of money that somebody from the top has directed to be put there. It's just, it may not be the most efficient way to go about doing that. The alternative approach, which We typically use is, you know, that we convene experts, if you will. We, you know, determine what are the best areas for the use of prizes. We do the work to figure out the specifics. And then we go to Congress with a specific proposal saying, you know, that, you know, here are a number of things that we've taken a careful look at. You know, here are the advantages of these kinds of competitions over contracting in these particular areas. We would like you to, you know, to put into our appropriations this year, the, you know, money for these specific prizes, you know, to do these specific, you know, specific actions. So I'll conclude with that.
Great, thank you, Dr.
I'll be very briefly, and I appreciate both sets of comments. As an initial matter, I certainly agree that the last point that Larry mentioned about the design issue, or this was not just the last point, but the design issues are very real. I don't think they're any more real with prizes than with traditional R&D fund allocation systems, but the grant making process is more something we have more experience with in the federal government, something that's been in place for a while that we've learned a lot about how to do, and we're not in that same place with prizes, although I do note McKinsey's done a very fairly comprehensive report on prizes, identifying a lot of the design questions and how to think about designing prizes, and there have been some other analyses done in the last few years, so these are real challenges. But just as when an agency puts out an RFP for a grant, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in making sure that the guidelines for the proposal are properly developed. That's true with prizes, but that is surmountable. And I agree with a lot of the points about the nature of agencies and how work has to be done to get them to pay more attention to prizes. In terms of my specific proposal, I'll just say a little bit about how I came up with it. I mean, what I basically did is said, well, you know, the U.S. Climate Change Technology Program is spending, at the time I wrote the original paper, was spending in the neighborhood of $3 billion a year. So we had already said, this is how much we're going to spend directly on R&D that we've identified as encouraging climate change technology. And so, I said, let's reallocate a portion of that, of the portion of the money that the federal government's already said we're devoting to this problem, and that I think by most estimates is grossly insufficient either to achieve what we want to achieve or grossly insufficient if we think we should be investing somewhere on the order of magnitude of the potential benefits from atmospheric stabilization. And so I'm not sure that yes, it's certainly true that the prizes you would then have would fill that amount of money, but I think that that's often true with money that's appropriated for grants as well. An agency's given a certain amount of money to dole out, the agency's going to dole out that money. I think some of Tim's comments on patents versus prizes, I mean, were particularly valuable, and there's certainly some stuff in there that if I were redoing this paper, I would want to make sure that I get in. The one point I would make is that in terms of the way I think of the paper and the proposal is, in the area of climate change and encouraging climate-friendly technologies, we're not on the margin of where deciding whether or not patents or prizes is really the key choice, or whether or not we want to be buying out patents or not buying out patents. I mean, if we recognize, as I believe, that we are in a position where where as a society we are grossly underinvesting in this sort of innovation, we have a long way to go before some of these choices really become really important. I mean, there is a point at which we would have to make choices about on the margin about how to encourage that next increment of innovation, but I don't think we're there yet. The last comment I'd make is on the issue of centralization. My point is not that prizes are wholly decentralized, but on the margin, they are more decentralized than traditional grants and traditional subsidies, and in ways that provide benefits. So yes, you need to have a centralized grant allocation mechanism. You need to have a centralized prize
criteria selection mechanism. And so in that respect, they're both centralized, but the universe of those that are eligible, the costs are that one that wants to seek either a grant or prize, that one has to assume to enter that process, the centralization of ex ante versus ex post evaluation. I think there are significant differences that lead to prizes being better at encouraging innovation, particularly if what we want is kind of dramatic innovation or large leap innovation of the sort that that we're not getting. But I agree that it's on the margin. It's not that we have. It's not cats versus dogs. It's you know, we're looking at different breeds of dogs and their comparative advantage at achieving certain sorts of goals. And so I'd agree with the analysis with that modification. I think that was all I was going to say. So.
Larry, Tim, do you have anything you want to add before we go to questions?
No, I'm fine.
I do, actually, based on something that Jonathan said and also that Larry said, just to kind of throw this out for discussion. Both talked about the benefits of prizes is in some sense that you get a lot more investment than the prize. And as an economist, I'm sort of skeptical about how often one can go to that well. Now, I realize I'm saying that in an era where people pay big money for internet companies that are startups with no apparent way of making any money. So perhaps this is, you know, I'm just being too traditional or something. But I sort of wonder whether the policy ought to be sort of argued for or sustained on the argument that a $1 million prize induces $10 million worth of investment. That's not to dispute the facts about what's happened, but it does lead one to wonder why and if one can keep doing that. There are people who've written about prize fatigue, for example. If the reward for this is, you know, winning something cool, well, if there's a million of these things, how, you know, is the one at the margin going to be that cool? Is it going to do this and that sort of thing? So I just kind of want to throw that out there, which is just to be careful if one's going to endorse as a policy on a kind of routine way that the base advocacy on the expectation that you're going to get this kind of a huge return systematically over time. That's not to say it hasn't happened already.
Did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I defend the claim and in this sense, that is, you know, if a prize is properly designed and you assume that the non-ego motivated prize pursuer is willing to invest more or less up to the value of the prize pursuing it, and you're going to have more than one, and you design it in a way that you're going to have more than one pursuing it, you are going to get more innovation or more investment in innovation towards that prize. I think where the concern comes is are there reasons to be concerned that what you're not doing is increasing the overall investment in innovation, but diverting investment in innovation away from certain types of innovation towards others? And I think that if we believe that we were anywhere close to the optimal level of investment in innovation towards climate-friendly technologies, I think that would be a very serious concern. But so long as we're, as I believe, nowhere near that point, I'm less worried about that, because I do believe you get more investment, more private investment in pursuing the prize than the value of the prize. And I believe that we are so below what would be the optimal level of investment in this sort of innovation that I'm not as worried about what it is that where this money might otherwise have gone. And I think that would be a real concern if, for example, carbon were priced, and as a result, people were investing more dramatically or more significantly in emission reduction technologies or even carbon capture technologies or whatever else. Well, then I think this would be a serious concern. We'd have to step back and say, okay, do we really believe that encouraging all these folks to pursue this social goal is going to be that much better than something else? And then that would be a tough question.
Sure. The other thing I'll try to point out was that, you know, this leverage of, you know, 10 to 1, 5 to 1, you know, whatever, of people going or collectively being willing to spend, you know, more than what the prize is worth, is is obviously very much tied to what their motivations are and what they see as a potential return. I mean, you know, a lot of this is, you know, financial return, a lot of it is ego return, and and the like. And so, the degree to which those factors are or are not present will greatly affect whether you're going to get even equal amounts of investment to what your prizes that you've offered. So I mean, it's very very much situational.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any questions from the audience? Yeah.
Can I just piggyback on that discussion and suggest that I think that's a real issue? I mean, are you basically just rewarding people that are already in the game, or are you doing it as you all suggested, you bring new players into this? And I guess from a very practical perspective, like what keeps people in or out of the game is the cost of innovation. Somebody has to fund that. You're going to design a good order, venture capitalists to pay that, or somehow you're getting that money. Obviously, grants are providing all or some of the cost for that innovation. Prizes are only rewarding the winners. And so where is the funding coming from the folks that are proposing to do this work? And what role does a potential prize play in that investment process? I'm wondering if there's any history, make it short, is there any history you can point to where the venture capitalists are coming to the table because there's a prize
the patent system. I mean, as Tim mentioned, when we model the patent system, we think about why it works because the person whoever is the first person to get the patent, and Tim has a footnote in his paper knowing that we can talk about, should be first to file, first to innovate, whatever else. But the point is, whoever crosses that line first gets a prize, right? They get a monopoly. They get they get the prospect, not the guarantee, but the prospect of super competitive returns. And I think most people would argue that in most markets, that the patent system works incredibly well at encouraging people to invest money in support of innovation that could potentially achieve that reward. The problem is that in a lot of environmental areas, and in climate in particular, we can't depend upon that. Because if I invent something that produces or enables us to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions in a particular application, or even to pull carbon out of the air in a really cost-effective way, there's no market for that. No one's going to buy that. Why? Because we have an open access commons for all practical purposes in the global atmosphere. So the patent system can't do that. But I mean, unless we think the patent system is grossly deficient in encouraging innovation where we don't have something like a commons problem that's going to result in systematic underinvestment in this sort of innovation, that's our model. And again, I think that works really well. Now, if we were going to talk about basic R&D and the like, then I don't think my analysis applies in those sorts of contexts, right? I wouldn't advocate using a prize for superparticle or accelerators, right? Because that requires a huge upfront investment that no one's going to do unlikely to do in the year of a prize. But in the climate context, what is it that we need? We need technologies that can be used by consumers, by companies, and so on, the world over, in practical applications. And that's the sort of thing that, again, the patent system does really well so long as the innovator can capture the value of their innovation. It can't with climate, so the prize is just trying to replicate that, and I see no reason why properly designed prizes, and again, it's not like we just say, "Ooh, let's have a prize tomorrow." We offer it, but a properly designed prize should be able to at least move us substantially in that direction and have the same type of success.
Any other questions? Yes.
What role does the private sector play in this issue of prizes? You talk primarily about
I mean, you have examples of private sector prizes. I cite in the longer version of the paper, I cite a bunch of them. The Netflix one is the most famous one. of a company offering a prize for something that they wanted. I mean, Netflix's case, right, they realized there is a lot of value in being able to predict more accurately what movies you're going to like, and that a way to provide a better service to their customers and maintain customer loyalty is to be better at saying, because you like movie A and movie B, you're going to like movie C. And they had an algorithm that worked pretty well, but they figured they could do a lot better, and they figured that they would do a better job, or they'd be more likely to really have a major advance in that algorithm if they opened it up to all comers rather than relying upon the folks that in their own company. And they were right, in the sense that some folks were able to do that. Some folks that weren't their employees, that they'd never heard of. But we can only depend upon that sort of thing where there's a company that sees something that it can profit from. The reason I think we focus on the government is because we generally think that the government plays a role in providing public goods. And I would argue that there are public good characteristics to the technologies that would help us stabilize atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, in part because we don't have any kind of price on carbon. So we can't expect, I mean, Branson and some other folks have funded, and I guess Progressive Insurance funded one, small prices here and there that might move us a little bit of the way there, but given the magnitude of the challenge and the sort of, I think we are, you know, the only entity that's likely to do this is the government. I mean, if the Pew Foundation or someone wanted to do this too, that'd be great. But I think we're talking about more zeros in terms of the overall amount of investment needed than private companies or even private foundations are likely to do.
In the purple.
My answer is kind of a quick and dirty one, in the sense that what I did in the original paper was I said, here's what the federal government said it's already going to spend on trying to encourage technological innovation. And even just viewing this as a portfolio strategy and saying we're going to diversify the tools we're using to encourage innovation out of that set amount of money, there are reasons to think that would get us greater return than using, you know, so you're just expanding the set of tools that we're using. I probably did that in part because politically I figured, you know, it's better to say, let's talk about using the money we're already going to spend more efficiently or more effectively than trying to come up with some big amount of number that, or some new big number that has to compete with all the other things that people want to put on the table. I mean, that's not an academically satisfying answer, but the aim was, you know, at the end, was to have some kind of policy relevant proposal, and so that's what I did. And the pitch that I make is, look, you know, if we're spending this money, shouldn't we do it in a way that maximizes the likelihood that the taxpayer is getting a return? And I think that at the very least, devoting some portion of what we're already characterizing as USCCTP money towards prizes increases the likelihood that we're going to maximize the return to the taxpayer. And I would hope that that's the sort of argument that would appeal to folks that are more concerned about the spending side, perhaps, than the climate side. But I'm not in the Beltway anymore, so, you know, I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly the hope.
Try to get another quick question. Anyone else? Yes, gentlemen back there.
In your text, you threw in the word commercially viable. I'm wondering whether you'd like to talk about how easy it is to have a kind of prize and define as part of this criteria commercial viability. Because any prize is going to have to be scaled, and I could just imagine that your fourth prize, which number four might scale much better than number one, and that could take a long time to see. So how do you actually manage to practically scale commercial viability for your fourth prize?
I mean, I mean, there have been prizes that have been structured in ways to get try and guarantee that. So, for example, there have been there are prize designs where you have to generate something that can be produced at a certain cost, or you have to build a certain number of them. There have even been efforts to try and design prizes where for certain types of innovations where you actually have to sell a certain number of something. And in the McKinsey study, as I recall, does talk some about that. There's also, you know, if we want to think about prize design, there are even ways to think about the use of procurement policy as in a way to create prize-like incentives. So, for example, if you figure that if the government's willing to spend a certain amount of money in an innovation and willing to spend another amount of money on to use a very simple example, purchasing a certain number of vehicles, well, that could give us an idea of the premium the government's willing to spend on vehicles that not only meet certain practical goals the government has, but that also achieve the social goal. And you could structure a procurement in a way to say, when we're going through this procurement process, if someone, in addition to offering the car or whatever else that meets certain practical goals, can also achieve the social goal, we'll add this premium to what we're willing to pay for X units. So, I mean, there are things like that you can do to try and close that gap. But that is a challenge in prize design, and you know, it is something that folks that work on this are paying attention to. So I don't want to pretend it's like easy and automatic. But we, you know, with R&D we face the same problem, right? I mean, if the Department of Energy says we're going to pay or give a grant to design a better solar panel, and that amount of money may help us get a great prototype, but there's still a lot of questions about, well, in approving the grant for this particular proposal, did we pick the one that actually is most likely to lead to something that's commercially viable? I mean, that gap exists with the alternative as well. And my kind of bottom line argument is, this is a comparative question. You know, if we're going to spend this money on the margin, are there reasons to say that prizes have comparative advantages at least some of the time? And do we maximize the chance of achieving this ultimate goal, being able to make it cheaper and easier to get climate stabilization, if at least some of our money is on the prize side? And so that's not a way of saying these problems aren't real or aren't there, but I think that it helps in that regard.
I was going to say, this may not be the most appealing example, but part of the reason that the Ansari X Prize required that they had to fly the same ship, the same thing in the suborbital flight twice within 2 weeks, I think it was, rather than once, was to deal with just that kind of a question. I mean, in the sense of doing it once may not prove that much, being able to show something that you can do to some degree again and perhaps again is, you know, addresses exactly that kind of an issue. I mean, that, again, that may not be the greatest example, but it is a concrete example of people trying to deal with that.
I think it's a really good example, right? Because what was the goal of the prize? The goal was to bring us closer to commercial spaceflight. And what would you need to make commercial spaceflight viable? Well, you'd need a vehicle that can do this repeatedly. Because any thought that anyone had put into the economics of it was that you needed a vehicle that could do this and then in a relatively short period of time turn around and do it again. And so built into the prize design was this proxy for that. Now it's a proxy. You know, it's possible someone could have come up with a vehicle that could do it twice and never do it again. But it turns out that the folks that invested in the winning team are already selling seats. So it turns out that prize did a pretty good job of coming up with a proxy for what they ultimately wanted. But it doesn't mean you're always going to do it. But it means that if you pay a lot of attention to that, you can often come pretty close, and that's what we want.
Well, another example is the L Prize, you know, by Department of Energy, which is the, you know, prize for, you know, coming up with a replacement for the 60-watt light bulb. You know, those will be hitting the shelves at, you know, your big box stores sometime this spring. You know, I saw the first production units a couple of weeks ago, and all of that was built around, you know, that, A, it's not just a stunt, it's not, you know, you got to be able to mass produce these things and, you know, and sell them at reasonable prices. I'll tell you.
All right, we're going to do one quick question from Mike.
So my question is just
following exactly up on this, is there something inherent in the nature of a prize that makes it more likely that you'll get high quality decision making, less political interference, or if you assume that that's not what you want? Or is it that we should could also better perform the other kinds of federal dollars being spent, whether through grants or other means? In other words, is there something inherent in the nature of a prize, other than, I guess, that you know what your outcome is, but I can imagine you could pick based on your brother-in-law's involvement in the project or whatever, as well. There's something about a prize, other than that you know what the outcome is, that makes it perhaps more likely to induce high-quality decision-making in that
one. Two things, and these are both on the margin. This is not black versus white. One is that insofar as it's harder to know who's going to get the money ex ante, that's less likely to be a motivation. Now, is it possible you could design a prize that's tailored for something that you know someone has or they haven't? Yeah, of course it's possible. But on the margin, there is at least more of a veil of ignorance. It's not complete, and so on the margin, we would therefore expect less. Manipulation or alteration of how the money goes, and with grants, you know, on the margin, blind peer review is better than earmarks on the same grounds. So it's a question of degree. The other reason I think that's why we expect certainly better results is that I do think the universe of potential innovators and the potential sources of innovation, the more open that is. The more likely we are to get what it is that we want, and I think that comes from certain views about the nature of innovation, and how the innovations that are most important and are the biggest breakthroughs are that because they were in some respect either serendipitous or unexpected, and so what it, so insofar as the government is encouraging innovation, we want a process that, again, compared to the alternatives, captures as much of that potential benefit as possible. Now it's not perfect because we're going to want. You know, prize criteria, and we often want to know who's investing in the prize up front and other things. And so it's we're still comparing that with the way you maybe respond to an RFP or whatever else. But the more we move in that direction, I think the more likely we are to get the sort of result that we want.
Just a very quick point. Just to keep a distinction in mind. I mean, there are prizes that are based upon very precise victory conditions, and those are going to be the best at achieving the goals Jonathan's talked about in the same way that essentially an untrained golfer could win the Masters, you know, as happened last week. But there are also prizes out there that for lack of a better term, are called beauty contests, which is, well, we think there's some, it's kind of like a grant competition. We think there's, you know, it would be a good idea to do something like this. People can commit a bunch of different ideas, and we're just going to sit around and pick the best one, and those may be a little more prone to that kind of finagling that you were talking about.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Fortunately, the lunches did finally arrive. But please join me in thanking the panel. It was an excellent discussion.
Thank you. We're
going to take about a five-minute break because we are running behind. There are box lunches at the table at the back, so please help yourself. And, yeah, we'll just eat during the next panel. Great job.
Hey, thanks very much.
Thank you for coming.
Really interesting discussion.
Thank you.